Today, I'm speaking with an Associate Dean of Medical School Admissions and fellow podcaster. We'll learn more about his informative podcast as well as admissions practices at the University of Utah's College of Medicine. Welcome to the 256th episode of Admissions Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you apply thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you show that you both fit in at your target school and are a standout in the applicant pool. The result? You get a message one day that causes you to jump up and down shouting, "Yes, I'm accepted!" And not only accepted, but accepted to the best program for you. This podcast is brought to you by our upcoming webinar, The Five-Step Guide to Successful Medical School Personal Statements, presented by Accepted's consultant, Jessica Pishko. It's not easy to boil down your life and reasons for pursuing a career in medicine into a too short personal statement. Let Jessica, an experienced medical school admissions consultant and published author, guide you through her excellent process that will save you time and improve your personal statement. The webinar is free, but please register as soon as possible, like now, at accepted.com/5steps. Again, that's accepted.com/5, STEPS. And the webinar is Monday, May 7th. Now, our guest today is Dr. Benjamin Chan, Associate Dean of Admissions and Idaho Affairs at the University of Utah School of Medicine, and also the host of the Talking Admissions and Med Student Life podcast. Dr. Chan earned his bachelor's at Stanford and his MD at the University of Utah College of Medicine. He then trained in general psychiatry at George Washington University in D.C. He has also completed a fellowship in child and adolescent psychiatry and has an MBA from the University of Utah and a master's in education from the University of Cincinnati. He is also an assistant professor of psychiatry and an inpatient attending physician at the University of Utah Neuropsychiatric Institute. Dr. Chan, welcome to Admission Straight Talk.
Thank you. Thank you for having me come on. I'm excited to be here.
I'm delighted to have you today. Now, can you give us an overview of Utah College of Medicine's curriculum, focusing on the more distinctive aspects of it?
Yeah, so our medical school, it's an allopathic medical school, meaning we grant the MD degree. It's 4 years long. And something that we're really excited about is we're just known for innovation. And so we're always trying new teaching techniques. And so we have implemented something recently called TBL, team-based learning, where the students teach each other and they break off into small groups. They go through cases, they debate amongst themselves, they teach amongst themselves, and they learn. So we're very excited about TBL. And so that's an innovative teaching technique. We also have something called Bench to Bedside. It's our bioinnovation project. A few years ago, there was this question of how do we take bench research and how do we translate that into helping patients more quickly? Because it can take years, decades. Sometimes it never happens at all. So what it is we break up the students into multidisciplinary teams. So these are students, our own medical students, as well as graduate students from main campus, such as computer science students or biology students or physics students. They go around, they interview doctors, they shadow doctors, and we provide some lab space and a little startup money, and they go back to their lab and they brainstorm ideas and they design prototypes. And so we have this annual gala. It's kind of like a science fair on steroids, if you will. And everyone comes together, brings their different inventions, their prototypes, their ideas, and they present them. And we have judges, and the judges go around, and they interview the students, and they play with their prototypes, and the judges pick winners.
I suspect they're more sophisticated than volcanoes with baking soda and vinegar.
Yes, extremely. One of the winners a few years back, and I think it's on stage three trials.
Wow.
It's this UV light that kills bacteria, and I'm not doing it justice. But instead of when you go in for surgery, they kind of splash the betadine to sterilize the field. So this is actually a catheter that kills the bacteria before you insert it into the skin. So this has a lot of implications across the world because sometimes you're in locations where you can't sterilize the surgical field. So this is a place where that has a lot of commercial potential. So going back to our curriculum, so we provide all these innovative kind of teaching methods and different kind of hands-on experiences for the students. And yeah, that's the kind of type of students that really thrive in our curriculum. So, you know, traditionally the first 2 years of med school is more classroom based, but we're starting to break that out more with some of those examples I gave you. And the last 2 years are clinic based or hospital based. And so in many ways we have a standard kind of curriculum, but we're introducing these innovative concepts into it.
Now, I noticed in preparing for the call, the curriculum is divided into four core areas that students participate in throughout their 4 years at Utah Medical: service scholarship and mentorship, then clinical medicine, then medical sciences, and medical arts. Now, clinical medicine and medical sciences, I assume, are what most people think of first, not necessarily in that order, when they think of medical school, right? You learn the sciences and you also have clinical exposure and you start to actually do stuff. But what is the service scholarship and mentorship portion and the medical arts portion?
Okay. Yeah, that's great. So let me start with
I guess they're examples of innovation, right? To tie back to your previous answer.
Yeah. In our curriculum, the medical arts or medical humanities is extremely important. As you mentioned, when students come to our school, when students go to any medical school, really, they learn a lot of hard facts: anatomy, physiology, pharmacology. Mm-hmm. It's incredibly important. But how does one take that information and how do you communicate it with your patients? Because you can have all the clinical scientific knowledge in the world, and if you can't share it, if you can't translate it, it does you no good. So mm-hmm. there's definitely a science of medicine, but there's also an art of medicine. And I feel our curriculum really combines the two, the art and science of medicine. So we have medical humanities. We talk about death and dying, how to interact with diverse patient populations, how to deal with bioethical issues as they arise in our modern U.S. healthcare system. So it's incredibly important. Again, that's spaced out over the 4 years. And then the first one you mentioned was service, scholarship, and mentorship. We really pride ourselves in making sure our students stay up to date with the latest technology, the latest research. I mean, there's a reason why in medicine we don't prescribe leeches anymore, right? Everything that we do is founded in science. Mm-hmm. And science is always changing and evolving. So most of our students, the vast majority of our students, engage in some type of research project during medical school. And going back to the service and mentorship, students who are third and fourth years help mentor the first and second years, and they help mentor pre-med students. So to me, it's always evolving. It's always growing. So yes, that's a service, scholarship, mentorship, as well as the medical arts or humanities.
I mean, I've talked to people who I interviewed the director of the Arnold P. Gold Foundation, you know, their honor society is like the humanism. Honor society, is this part of what the medical arts are in your view? It's not literature and medicine, it's human interaction in medicine.
Yes, it's human action. It's you know, because you can learn all about, for example, diabetes. You can learn all about diabetes, and it's in a way it can be very scientific and very rote. And there's, you can talk about insulin sliding scales and glucagon and glucagon and things like that. Right. But how do you talk to someone who's just been diagnosed with diabetes and it's really hard and it's devastating and all these cultural things kind of enter into it, because we eat food and like food is a very social event. And how do you navigate that? So the Arnold P. Gold Humanism Foundation is a fantastic, and we participate in that. And we do have some really great students who are great. I mean, and kind of jumping ahead, you know, might be going out of order.
You don't have to stay.
But our admissions, our admissions committee, they love seeing that humanitarianism, that humanism in their applicants. And that's how you really set an application apart. I mean, this goes into holistic review, but we can fill our medical school up with people with really great MCATs and GPAs. What mm-hmm. the committee really looks for is, you know, giving back to the community, a really strong volunteer track record, and having those meaningful interactions with others. So that's what I would say to that. Yes, definitely humanism is extremely important.
And when you talk about volunteer track record, do you mean commitment to one or two things or causes or experiences that an applicant finds particularly meaningful, or do you mean a lot of different things?
It's individualized. It kind of depends. I know that's kind of a cop-out answer.
No, so sounds like an honest one.
Yeah. What the committee really values is they value applicants who go outside their comfort zone and grow. And the way to think about it is, like, you know, when you and I, when we went off to college, we are immersed in this world of different experiences. We're among different people, different ideas. I mean, that's kind of the point of college in some mm-hmm. level. Mm-hmm. And so the committee loves seeing people who go outside their comfort zone and start volunteering with different organizations. And sometimes that organization will click and the applicant will just grow. And the committee loves to see that. Well, if someone starts gaining responsibility or leadership positions within the community service, the committee loves that. But other times it doesn't click, and that's okay. And the committee also recognizes that, like, you know what, if you're, you know, Habitat for Humanity, if you're not really great at building homes or things like that, and that's not your cup of tea, you shouldn't go down that road.
But they just hammer your thumb.
Yeah, you got to be careful. Yeah.
Right.
Very true. Very true. Yeah, so that's kind of the beautiful thing about admissions. I realize, because I talk to a lot of pre-med students. I do a fair amount of
communication. Sure you do.
And I feel like the culture of pre-med encourages checking boxes or box checking, as I call it. And it's really hard to kind of break out of that mold. I mean, you always have to do X, Y, and Z, and I'm not sure if we'll ever get away with that. But the applicants who truly stand apart can demonstrate a very impressive application with service and growth and meaning. And that's communicated by your activities, how you describe them, how you write about them. So there's a lot more thought that goes into applications than people realize. And the committee spends a lot of time reading through these applications.
I think what I was trying to get at with my question wasn't so much that applicants or college students, because that's what, you know, let's face it, they're first college students before they become applicants, that a certain amount of experimentation and testing of different things is perfectly normal. And it's normal. It's almost encouraged. It's healthy. But at the same time, for the applicant who feels they kind of have to go after every volunteer experience without any deep commitment or any deep engagement with anyone, in other words, if none of them resonate with them, then something's off, you know? So that's, I think, what I was trying to get at with my question. But I'd like to go back to the curriculum before we do turn more to the admission side of things. And I noticed also in reviewing your site that there's a certain focus on practice-based learning. I mean, I can understand what that is, like once you're out of medical school and you're in practice, but what does that mean when you're in medical school? I know you talked about problem-based learning, but what's practice-based learning?
So practice-based learning, so again, like the first 2 years of med school has historically been very classroom-based, and then the next 2 years are very hospital and clinic-based. And we felt that it's kind of jarring. You go from one setting to another. So we strive to have our medical students during the first 2 years go out and practice in the community. So we pair them with primary care physicians or specialist physicians and to help kind of develop those skills. Because the students are learning how to be doctors. We have this course called CMC or Clinical Method Curriculum. Mm-hmm. This is where they learn physical exam skills or how to interview a patient or how to write a progress note. And we have something called the Clinical Skills Lab, where it's kind of like a mock patient room. I mean, we've all seen it. You go in there, there's like a little sink, an exam table. So we can practice a lot. And we have something called SPs, or standardized patients, which are just fake patients.
Mm-hmm.
And they're volunteers, actors, actresses. They're volunteers from the community, and they come in, and they pretend they have chest pain, or they pretend they have their leg hurts or their back hurts. So our students do really great, and it's kind of a controlled environment. And there's some coaching involved because the standardized patients like kind of give them these little nuggets. But the problem is life is a lot more messy than that. It's a lot more complicated. So we strive to have them go out in the community and pair them with doctors so they can see, all right, this is how in a busy clinic, how you see patients, how you write a progress note, how you kind of take charge of the healthcare team and kind of navigate this, you know, typical clinic or hospital workday. So that's what practice-based learning means to us.
Okay. Now, just to change gears entirely, you are the host of the Talking Admissions and Med Student Life podcast. You are the first admissions director that I've ever spoken to who has your own podcast. How, why, can you tell us about the show and why did you decide to start the podcast?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I don't think I've ever been asked this before. So,
really?
So way back in the day, back to, you know, when I did my residency, training out in Washington, D.C., and I did my fellowship up in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And because I was living in D.C. at the time and I had a lot of friends and I was dating someone, when I matched up in Baltimore, I made the fateful decision, like, you know what, I'm not going to move to Baltimore. I'll just drive back and forth from the two cities, which it's a long commute. And I just remember just listening to the radio. And then I got really hooked on NPR and the Diane Rehm show. And I just loved that type of radio. And then, so when podcasts started getting introduced, I started like taping podcasts or like keeping them. I had a little iPod Touch back then. I'm not sure if your listeners will remember those. So but then I just started listening to podcasts because at a certain, like, oh, I don't want to listen to all these commercials. I enjoyed Diane Rehm's voice and kind of the intellectual kind of conversation she brought to the table. So when I started doing missions, I took over the missions office in 2012. We, you know, life happened. I got married. We had kids. We moved back to Utah. And, you know, I started doing missions. I noticed, you know, as I go out and do these tours, that I would give a presentation and be a large audience. And then afterwards, I'd always linger a little bit longer to take questions, right? And so like a queue would form. And there's two things I know. So first thing is that the very smart people would just kind of hover near the front, because they didn't really have questions for me per se, but they wanted to listen to me answer all these questions. They just kind of wanted to gather the information. So that's the first thing I noticed. And the second thing is the first person in the line and the last person in the line tended to ask the exact same question. So I found myself repeating myself again and again and again. So I had this thought, like, you know what? Why don't I just create a podcast series and bring people on and just talk about admissions, talk about what happens inside medical school. And that way people can listen to this conversation and I don't have to repeat myself as much. And we can just go in strange, interesting, fun ways. And it's been very beautiful. Again, if you told me 10 years ago or 5 years ago that I would be doing a podcast, I would never believe you. You know, it's like, because that was like something, it was like an other. It was like out in the ether. I couldn't do that. But it's been really beautiful. I've just learned so much along the way. And apparently people are listening. More and more people come up to me and talk to me about the podcast. And you probably get this, but I get unsolicited advice sometimes. People say, oh, you should do this for this podcast, or you should have this guest on, or you need to kind of do this segment here. And I'm just like, oh, okay. I do my best. So, and everyone's a critic on some level. But yeah, it's been beautiful. I've really enjoyed it. I just love talking to people. I'm a psychiatrist by nature, and it's just kind of a natural evolution. So yeah, I love the podcast. And how long have you been doing this podcast of yours, the Accepted Podcast?
It's about 5 years. Now, the first year, I wasn't as regular as I should have been about it. And after about a year, I looked at the numbers and I just thought about it. And I said, all right, either I'm going to do this once a week or I'm going to stop. You know, either I'm going to go full in or I'm not going to do it at all. And since then, it's been once a week. I do occasionally have what I call encore shows if I go on vacation or whatever. Otherwise, I've been very committed to it. And I enjoy it enormously. I've met very interesting people like yourself. I've talked to them. People I've never would have had the opportunity to meet and talk to. And I think it's a tremendous service. It's also grown for the applicant community. I like the medium. I too enjoy listening to podcasts a lot. I listen to them constantly. So it's been like that. The funny thing for me is I usually record the podcast from my home office. And the mic in my home office is the biggest conversation piece in the whole house. Mm.
Interesting.
People can see it when they come in and they're like, what is that? So that's kind of funny. Yeah. But
I like how you said, to me, it's a type of service, because I was a pre-med not too long ago. I stay in regular contact with our students, and it's so competitive out there. There's so much information and misinformation.
Yes.
And there's so many websites. And so to me, just trying to cut through the clutter, the haze, to me, it's just like, okay, you're going to hear from the admissions dean. I'm going to tell you how it is. And you're just going to hear me have normal, quote unquote, normal conversations with other students, other physicians, other like residency program directors, pre-med advisors. And let's just talk about admissions. And I'll give you my thoughts and comments, but also you'll hear someone else's perspective. And it can be really hard, especially if you don't come from a family of medicine. I mean, it's very like how do these people get to be cardiovascular surgeons? How do people reach this point? And so it helps kind of break down barriers. And so, yeah, I see it as a service as well.
One of the most poignant interviews I think I ever had was with a guy who's, I think, probably at the very end of his orthopedic residency. And he came from a very disadvantaged background in Louisiana. I mean, he wrote about it. He talked about it. He really, really struggled. And he ultimately was accepted to a post-bac program, got into medical school, and then matched at one of the most competitive residencies out there. And awesome. it was a really inspiring kind of story. It was just a pleasure talking to him. And I'll link to that in the show notes. I don't remember the number off the top of my head, but I'll link to it from our show notes at accepted.com/256. But it was a wonderful episode. He'd make a good guest for you too. He'd make a good guest for you. Okay.
Yeah.
So there's some unsolicited advice.
Yeah, that's right. Awesome. Well, to kind of throw the question back at you, why don't you think more admission deans or admission directors do podcasts? I mean, what's holding people back? Because as I've learned to do this, I don't see the technology being a barrier. You prioritize items in your life, so I don't think time is a barrier. Why aren't people doing this more?
I'm not sure I have the answer. I would suspect that time is a barrier. It does take commitment and it takes discipline. You just based on the number of degrees and fellowships that you have, you must be a very, very disciplined person. And the things that you're responsible for, you must be very good at time management. Not everybody else is. So I would suspect that that's part of it. I agree that the technology is not an issue. It's very easy. I think it's probably more time. And I think there might also, some people may be not so comfortable kind of putting themselves out there. What if the guest says something wrong, or, you know, I say something wrong, and, you know, that kind of stuff. But I think just making one more commitment in a very busy day can sometimes be a little overwhelming. How am I going to find guests? And what if I'm boring? That kind of stuff. But yeah. I guess it's what those problems didn't stop either of us.
Yeah, and I think that's great. And what I've noticed too is, as I've done this more and more, our own medical students have approached me because they want to host their own podcast series.
Oh, really?
So there's kind of like this like little homegrown podcast movement. And what they don't realize, because like I've had this conversation with multiple ones over the years, is that it always starts off strong, and then going back to like time, and they get busy studying for tests and boards and things like that, it kind of tapers off. So, but yeah, I just see it such, again, I just love it as a service, and I just love doing it. We should probably hold workshops to help teach other people how to do it. Cause like, I agree. Like the way students learn now, it's so fascinating to me. Cause like, you know, back in my day in medical school, we had Palm Pilots. Do you remember Palm Pilots?
Yes,
remember
course.
How those were the rage? But now the students
back in my podcasts. Day, we had pen and paper, but go ahead.
The students use podcasts to learn, study for boards now, and they have all these phone apps, and there's all these names of different organizations that they tell me, oh, they have like test bank questions or this or that. I'm just like, wow, there's so much material out there. So I think students, this millennial generation, they can listen to a podcast and study and do two other things. They're great at multitasking, and I'm just happy to be part of that movement. It's great.
Well, I'm more into listening to podcasts while I'm at the gym or on a walk or something like that. I can't like read and listen to a podcast. That means I won't take in the podcast and I won't take in what I'm reading. But, you know, I definitely enjoy it. So anyways, let's get back to medical school admissions.
Sure.
All right. University of Utah had 3,871 applications last year, according to MSAR, and winnowed that down to 500 interviews for 125 spots in your last incoming class. In-state applications had a roughly 18% matriculation rate, but out-of-state applications had a 1% matriculation rate. How does your staff sift through all those applications and winnow it down? Other than stats, and you touched on this at the very beginning of the interview, what separates those invited to interview from those not invited?
Great question. And yeah, just to kind of give people a sense of what's going on, you've probably heard this. Well, let me just say it my way.
Sure.
So, our medical school, the admissions process, we in no way discriminate based on age, race, religion, ethnicity, anything like that. However, we do discriminate heavily based on state residency.
Okay. That's pretty clear.
We're a state school. We're not a private school. So we're a state school. And our mission, our mandate is to serve the citizens of Utah and Idaho. We do have a contract with Idaho. So if you're a Utah or Idaho applicant, the chances of you being offered an interview as well as ultimately being accepted are much, much higher. Mm-hmm. That being said, we have 125 positions. 100 of those have to be a Utah resident or a non-resident who graduated a Utah high school, college, university. So to answer your first question, having some sort of Utah connection certainly helps the non-residents, such as coming from a Utah high school, college, university. Then of those remaining 25 spots, we have a contract with Idaho, 10 spots for Idaho. And then those 15 are the non-resident spots. And if you look at our application count, so you cited last year's statistics. This past year, we had 4,300 applications. Give or take, I would say 800 or so fit inside the Utah and the Idaho category. And there are thousands and thousands of people
going
who
for
are applying
spots.
From out of state for those 15 spots. I call that our Hunger Games pool. It's extremely competitive. And so what does our committee look for? So if you're a non-resident and you're interested in our school, first of all, it helps to have some sort of connection. So either having a family member, or if you did research in Utah or lived in Utah or went to school in Utah, that certainly helps get offered an interview. And the second thing is, you alluded to it, is a really strong community service track record really makes your application stand out. Again, we don't look for, you know, like high MCATs or GPAs are important. I don't mean to minimize that, but again, we have so many thousands of people applying. We really look for, okay, what did this person do? What did they spend their time with? And it's fascinating. So when I look at people's applications, because like when you fill out your med school application, you can kind of like, you can like check like, oh, I do hobbies. And it's normal for people to have hobbies. But it looks odd to admission committees when you check, okay, I'm doing hobbies. I like to run. I like to mountain climb. I like to ski. And you write down, I did that for like 3,000 hours. But then you come into your community service, like, oh, I only volunteered at the homeless shelter for 10 hours. I mean, what's that communicating to admission committees?
Like, you're checking the box.
You're training to be a professional athlete. You know, that's where your priorities are. So, there's kind of this method to it. Like, you need to kind of take a step back and look at your application. Like, what are you trying to say exactly with your time? You know, everyone's busy. Everyone has, you know, stuff going on in their lives. But like, for the truly great applicants, like, we can see, oh wow, they really are dedicated to helping disadvantaged populations. They mentor, they teach, they tutor, they're a TA, and they've given their time, and they've just made a world of difference for so many people. You know, I would argue, I'm sorry, I'm on my soapbox now.
Go for it.
The people who apply to med school, our med students, our applicants are some of the best students in the country or in the world. They have all these skills, leadership skills, community service skills, communication skills. There are people out there in the community that just need their help. And it can be as simple as being a big SIB, one-on-one, or it could be founding an organization. That is so important for our future physicians. So our admissions process, I feel, is very holistic. MCATs and GPAs are important, but they look at other areas, including community service, research, leadership, shadowing doctors. Our committee looks for well-rounded applicants, because that's our definition of well-roundedness. There's more to becoming a doctor than just doing well on tests. There's giving back to the community. There's communicating well. There's demonstrating leadership. It's so multifactorial. So the reason why we stress this in the admissions process is we have our expectations that our graduates will go on to become excellent physicians who also give back to the community. So that's my soapbox. Like, it just tears me up that I see people with perfect MCATs and GPAs, and that's all they've done is academics, academics, academics. And there's none of that humanism. There's none of that interacting with other people. Again, there's more to becoming a doctor than just doing well on tests. There's all these other skills that need to come through. So that's my soapbox. I'll get off my soapbox now.
No, that's all right. It was a good soapbox. I liked it. We once had a child who needed to go regularly to a certain clinic at UCLA. And I'll never forget this. This was over 20 years ago. There was a little playroom in the clinic for the kids, and at the time they would play, you know, like Disney videos, cartoons. So in this playroom, some kids would play and some kids would, and the video would play in the background. And there was a volunteer sitting in the playroom, and he was just sitting there watching the cartoon. And every so often somebody would come in, you know, a nurse or somebody from the staff, and say, oh, could you take this specimen here? Could you take this specimen there? But you could kind of see when they looked at him that they weren't very happy, because he wasn't really, he was just really just sitting there waiting to go fetch. And he could have been interacting with the children. They would have loved to have had a young adult interacting with them and playing with them. And I was thinking to myself, what a waste. He's just checking the box.
Yep. And I'm pretty sure if that individual approached their supervisor to write them a letter of recommendation, because it doesn't sound like he had a lot of insight, they're not going to write him a very good letter of recommendation.
Or they wouldn't write one at all. Or they'd refuse. They would refuse.
Yeah, if he was lucky. I've noticed people tend to avoid conflict at all possible. So we've just seen some really bizarre letters of disrecommendation.
Really?
People approach someone and they don't want to say,
he was really good at taking specimens to the lab. He did a great job.
Yeah. I always tell people, when you approach someone, like, will you write me a letter of recommendation? The next immediate follow-up question would be, do you feel comfortable in writing me a great letter of recommendation? And, you know, you can really avoid a lot of heartache and pain if you really pick great letter writers. So, yeah, letters can be like, yeah, they can make or break an application. I think not only what the letter writers say about someone is incredibly important, it's also incumbent upon the applicant to pick really good people. So again, going back to my example, if your entire application, well, not your, if one of the strengths, one of the, you know, one of the things you've done in your life as an undergrad is, you know, I was in this really great research lab. You spent hundreds of hours in the research lab. It's most meaningful to you. You write about it in your personal statements. You talk about it on an interview day. It looks super weird to the admissions committee that you never got a letter recommendation from that person in the lab. Do you understand what I'm saying? So like, there's a lot of thought that needs to go into, like, you know, picking who writes you letters. And I think people automatically think, oh, I'm going to get my physics professor or my biology professor. And if you're in this huge classroom, tons of people, those professors may not know you very well. It's better to get a letter. You know, people always ask me, is it like, what about the TA? The TA doesn't have the initials behind their degrees. Like, well, does the TA know you? Like, oh, yeah, I've worked with the TA for a long time. Can they write you a great letter? Like, oh, I think so. Yeah. Then go with that person. You know, like every once in a while I get this question. I call it, the Barack Obama question. Like, oh, Dr. Chan, if President Obama wrote me a letter, wouldn't that be awesome? And I said, I always follow up. And you can
I wrote a blog post. I wrote a blog post entitled what if the president would write your letter of recommendation? I actually have it on the site.
Okay, I will
do it.
So you swap out President Obama and put any VIP there. And I always ask the applicant, because like you, it's 99% of the time it's no. Like, does this person know you? It's like, well, no, they don't. Like, so what good does it do to write you a letter? Because it's going to be very obvious to the committee. It's going to be short, pithy, not very detailed. It's not going to have any personal anecdotes. So it's always better to have someone write you an awesome letter who knows you really, really well, not just someone you think is very impressive to the committee. So. Again, I got back on my soapbox. I'll come back down now.
I like your soapbox. It's okay. Let's see what kind of soapbox the next question elicits. You've mentioned the importance of humanism and obviously clinical exposure and community service. What about research?
Research is one of our recommended criteria to medical school. Going back to my example of the leeches, yes, like the science medicine is always evolving. Now, having said that, we have a very broad definition of research. Applicants just have to have a research experience. It can be part of a class. It does not have to be in the hard sciences. So you don't need to necessarily do physics, biology, chemistry. People apply and get in all the time who do research in business or marketing or psychology, agriculture. We get that a fair amount being here in Utah.
Sure.
It just has to be hypothesis based and it just has to be a research experience. So if you do a research paper, for one of your classes, you can count that. Now, if you follow up and ask me like, well, Dr. Chan, what if I joined a research lab and I did independent research and it actually got published or I did a poster presentation? Is that better? And yes, that is better. I mean, that does look better to admission committee members, but we do recommend all our applicants to have some type of research experience. Because again, there's a method to the madness. We teach the scientific method throughout our medical school, and we want our doctors to go on and continue to improve and just get used to the new science and medicine that will continue to be part of the healthcare field. So research is important. It's not the be all end all. You know, with the class size 125, I have some really great researchers in there. They will go on to become physician scientists. Other people will probably never engage in research, but we do, you know, you do have monthly journals. You do have like meetings to attend, you know. Yeah. I mean, I get these, I'm a child and adolescent psychiatrist. So I get I call it the orange journal. Like doctors are kind of lazy. Whatever the color of the journal is, we just kind of name it. You know, that's not the official name, but there's like a green journal, there's a red journal. So I get this orange journal every month, and it's incumbent upon me as a doc to read through the latest studies, to figure out what's going on with the new medications, because those research articles are going to determine if and how I change the way I practice psychiatry or medicine. And that's how I kind of phrase it to people. And people say, oh, I understand that. I get that. So we need to see the genesis, the development of those skills in our applicants. So that's why we ask for a little bit of research experience.
Okay. How do you evaluate multiple MCAT scores in an application? I mean, let's say, I don't know, an applicant didn't do so well. Let's say their grades are okay, but the first time they took the MCAT, their MCAT score was not what you would have liked to see and not what they wanted to see. And then they take it again, and they do really well. How do you look at that?
So, I mean, let me answer your questions in two ways. So the first way is just a logistical standpoint. We only look at the most recent score. All right. So we understand that life happens. Sometimes people take tests and they don't do very well. People just need to improve the second time they're tested. The vast majority of people improve on the MCAT if they take it multiple times. So that's the first part. But then to answer your question more philosophically, going back to holistic review, what we do at our medical school, which I think is unique, as I've talked to other admission deans elsewhere, is I actually shield the committee from the scores. So the admissions committee, they don't actually see the scores because we have found that that creates bias. So if someone with a perfect MCAT or GPA comes through and the admission committee sees that, they start making excuses like, oh, well, you know, this person doesn't have a lot of community service, or they couldn't talk about their research, or they didn't interview very well, but they have perfect scores. Right. And on the flip side, if someone has, you know, lower scores, but they have outstanding community service, they have great research, they interviewed extremely well, they're very impressive, those low scores create bias. It starts pulling down the application. Mm-hmm. So what I tell the committee is like, I don't, we have a culture here where they haven't asked for it. I know at other schools, sometimes there's kind of this tug of war because the admission committees like the scores. I shield it. They can't see them.
Really?
They only focus on So they focus on the personal statements, the letters of recommendation, the different activities that the applicant has chosen and how they describe them, which ones are most meaningful and why, and their interview day performance. And we have a formula, and I can talk about it because I share it on, I try to be as transparent as possible. So the MCAT GPA is important. It's worth a third of our final calculation, or how we generate our final ranking. Interview day for performance, and we do something called MMI, or multiple mini interview. Mm-hmm. We also do a couple cool other innovative, you know, assessment methods. We do something called a situational judgment test, as well as a standardized video interview. We're kind of experimenting with those. That's worth another third. And then the selection committee vote is worth a final third. So a third, a third, a third, and that equals 100%. And that's how we generate our final ranking. So, and I purposely don't have the MCAT GPA involved in the selection, the admissions committee, because I feel it really creates bias, and I try to eliminate that as much as I can.
Does it sound
radically different than from other programs, or?
It sounds quite a bit different to me, yeah. So when you, I mean, I know there are some schools that won't send secondaries out unless, you know, the MCAT is above a certain level. MCAT and GPA are above a certain level.
Yeah, we do have our minimum thresholds.
Okay.
So ours is, it's a 3.0 for a GPA, mm-hmm. and for the MCAT, it's a 492 or 123 in each of the four sections. But that's like 25th percentile. That's not very high.
Right. Yeah.
That's what our curriculum folk have told me. That's the absolute minimums that they need to have someone succeed in our curriculum. Having said that, our average for an incoming student is around a 510, and the GPA is around a 3.7. But you know, as I tell people, kind of, because I have these data slides, I show people like, mm-hmm. all right, so the average is 510. What does that mean? Like, that means half the class was below a 510.
Right.
And that means half the class was above a 510. All right. So
right.
People tend to kind of overly fixate on the score. So to me, it's like a cost benefit analysis. Like, people come up to me all the time and say, "Oh, Dr. Chan, I got a 501 on my MCAT. I'm really disappointed by it. I want to retake it." And I tell them, "Okay, look at your schedule. For you to take the MCAT, you know yourself best. Let's say it takes 400 hours of studying between now and like 5 months from now, and you might get a 502 or 503. I mean, you know yourself best. Why don't you take that time and do a really awesome community service project? Or why don't you get involved in a research lab?" And so I see this light coming on applicants sometimes going, "Really?" So like, yes. And then I explain to them what I just explained to you, the holistic concept of holistic review and how our admissions committee works. And then they realize like, oh, you know, like, I would much rather be doing something out with, you know, disadvantaged kids or at-risk youth or something like that than just, you know, in the library, just trying to study just to raise my MCAT score by a couple of points. I say, yes, you got it. You know, you're starting to understand how the admission committee feels. So, you know, that's what I kind of tell people with this cost benefit analysis.
So let me see if I got this straight. So sure. An application comes in, let's say it meets the minimums, and your committee reviews it first with the GPA and the MCAT scores hidden. So they're blind to that. Okay. Then they do some kind of ranking based on that. And then at some point, the GPA and MCAT come in, and then you decide whom to interview, or you decide to interview without knowing that information?
So we download the applications from MCAS. So if they check, you know, the American College Application Services, Medical College Application Service. So we, if they check our box, we download their applications, and we get to see everything they send to MCAS, including their MCAT or GPA. Now, we send out secondary applications to everyone who is above our minimum threshold for MCAT or GPA. So that generates a secondary application. The applicants receive that, and they fill out the secondary application, and we ask for further clarification in five other areas. Community service, leadership, research, physician shadowing, and patient exposure. So if an applicant, and you know, and it's not like I hide this, this is all on our website, it's all on our social media sites, we have YouTube clips, we've got podcasts. So if an applicant returns a secondary application, even if they meet our minimums MCAT GPA, but they write in a big fat zero for research or community service, we don't interview them. You understand what I'm saying?
We need, so
that gets triaged. So that gets triaged. So applicants who meet the minimums in all seven of those areas, so those five areas plus MCAT GPA, they are most likely to get an interview offer if they're a Utah or Idaho resident. Now, the non-residents, we really focus on the community service, and we make sure that's really outstanding, and that helps generate an interview for the non-residents. So last year, 4,300 applications, we interviewed about 550 for 125 spots. It's a roughly 4-to-1 ratio, give or take. And we maintain those ratios for those pools I mentioned. So we only interviewed about 400 or some odd Utah residents or non-residents who graduated from Utah High School, College, University for those 100 spots, about 50, 60 Idahoans for those 10 spots, and then the rest were for the non-residents. And so after they interview, then we get all the MMI data and the SJT and SVI data, and that's part of the application. Then it goes on to the final admissions committee, and that's where they no longer see the MCAT or GPA.
I see. Okay, I got it.
It's very clear in my mind, but sometimes when I explain it to people, because every process is slightly different.
Right.
With your experience, you probably have heard many different processes.
Yes. And what about, what's the role, let's say, now we talked about a higher MCAT, and I realize it's a holistic admission, so obviously everything is kind of thrown into the pot and weighed. But what about the person who didn't do so well as an undergrad, then gets motivated and applies themselves in a related master's? I don't know, they get a master's in epidemiology or biophysics or public health, but with a scientific focus. I mean, is that discounted because it's a graduate GPA and graduate GPAs are generally higher than undergraduate GPAs? How do you kind of view that?
So first of all, when we calculate the GPA, we look at your entire GPA. So I know there's some medical schools that split off like the undergrad and the grad. We just take a score and we just, you know, what's your GPA? And then like MCAS does this for all and calculates our overall GPA. And we just take that.
Okay.
What starts to happen is, and this is my own personal philosophy injected into it, like we start going down this road of, oh, you know, grad GPAs are a little bit higher than undergrad GPAs, or this medical or this undergrad is a much harder physics, you know, reputation. So an A in that course over there is worth more than a minus over here. And I don't want to take sides in that world. So your GPA is your GPA, and it just has to be above a 3.0, which is a B average, which I think, I think is justifiable. I think that's a really low, I mean, that's a low threshold. Now, when you talk about the committee doesn't see the GPA. So they don't really, you know, they don't really weigh in on that. They don't really talk about it. You know, another way to answer your question, and I'm not sure if this is what you meant, you know, like, you know, I don't think applicants should try to get in the habit of trying to prove to admission committees that they belong in medical school because of academics. So little warning bells go off in the admissions committee when so-and-so like, oh, you know, I didn't do very well in undergrad, and then I went off to do this grad program to show you I deserve to be in your med school. And I know there's all these post-bac programs that have popped up across the country.
Yeah.
And they kind of sell themselves on this. And I tell people, again, it's a cost-benefit analysis. Like, if your GPA is like a 2.9, yes, you need to go and raise your GPA somehow. You don't need to pay 50, 60 grand a year to join these post-bac programs to do that. You can just take classes at your local university or college. And what I've noticed, these post-bac programs, they're not very, and I don't know, maybe you want me to come back. I'll get into like a verbal fight with someone from one of these programs. Like, these programs are not very holistically minded, meaning that when we see their applications, like there's a lot of them on the East Coast. And like, if you're in Baltimore, New York, or Washington, D.C., we'd like to see a little bit of community service. And like, these programs rarely have community outreach, and they rarely have people put into research labs. So they focus overly on academics, to me, to the detriment of other parts of the application. And the committee, they just feel everyone is qualified academically. It's more of a question of, are your motivations the right motivations? Are you mature enough? Are you mentally prepared for the rigors of medical school? That's much more what the committee talks about than like, oh, this person is academically qualified and this person's not. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. I mean, I think that there are post-bac, there are obviously better and worse post-bac programs. And I know that there are many post-bac programs that strongly encourage participants to get clinical exposure, to be involved in research, et cetera. But obviously, especially for those programs that are academic enhancement programs, the focus is on equipping the students with the study skills, not only to get through the program, but to do well in medical school. Now, what can someone invited to interview at the University of Utah expect?
Great question. So we participate in three different assessment methods. The first of all is multiple mini interview. Have you had any guests ever talk about MMI?
Okay, all right.
So I won't belabor the point. It's like speed dating. Everyone's heard about it. Just Google it. You can watch a bunch of YouTube clips and learn more about it. So we do MMI. We have 8 stations for MMI. It's fairly straightforward. I know there are some medical schools that hire actors and do cooperation stations and things like that. We don't do that yet, but that could be in the future. But it's just simple MMI. And then the way to think about our day, so those are 8 stations. Another assessment we do is something called the Situational Judgment Test, SJT, and we're partnering with the AAMC. These are questions that are ethical. So the way to think about it, MMI, you're asked an ethical question and you talk through it. And SJT, we actually created a multiple choice pencil and paper test. And so you're asked to kind of go through and just kind of answer these questions. We're doing a lot of really cool research into this and we're learning more about it. They use situational judgment tests in the European medical education system. We're one of only a handful of medical schools that have started to adopt it here in the U.S. So we're very excited about this. And then the last one is something new we just did this past year. And I believe only us and University of Texas at Austin, the Dale Medical School, I've used it. It's called the Standardized Video Interview. So
this is the first really time I've heard of that. That's definitely new for me.
Yeah, right. So SVI. So essentially, applicants log in. This is something that happens before their interview day. So this is another reason why I'm really excited about it, because it can kind of – so the applicants log into it before they come here. They're posed 4 questions. So there's 4 verbal questions and 1 written question, a typing question. On the screen, it kind of like, oh, like, you know, why do you want to be a doctor? And then it gives the applicants 30 seconds to think about it, reflect upon it. And then the webcam turns on and records their verbal response for 3 minutes, or might have been 2.5. So there's 4 of those questions. And then the last one is there's a question, and then they had kind of like, and then a Word document kind of pops up and they type in their answers. So we store those in the cloud, and then my committee members can review those at their leisure, at their own schedule. So it's, we call that asynchronous. It's not live. It's not like a Skype live interview. It's recorded in the cloud, and it can be watched at a later date. Very fascinating. They actually use this type of interview when fourth-year medical students interview for emergency medicine residency programs. So when I first heard about this a couple years ago, I'm going, oh, okay, it sounds like, you know, we're moving towards that. And again, it's experimental, it's innovative, it's new. So the way to think about an interview day is there's 10 stations, 8 MMI stations, the SJT is considered another station, a 9th station, and the video interview is considered a 10th station. And all of that equals that third. And we're looking at the data right now. We might change those percentages for next cycle, but the data so far looks very promising. And it's just to me, like, it's another way to be assessed. And like, people sometimes say, oh, you know, it's not a true interview because there's not a give and take. It's not back and forth, kind of like what we're doing now. Having said that, I think there is value to it because multiple people can watch it and kind of say, oh, you know, like they really answered this question greater, you know. So, I mean, like, any questions about that? I don't know if I'm explaining it correctly.
Yeah, no, you are explaining it. By the way, and that is video interviews are increasingly used in business school admissions and in some business employment.
Oh, yeah. There's tons of – see, that's the cool thing. There's a lot of research in the corporate world, Fortune 500 mm-hmm. companies.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what they do. And there's some pretty good science behind it on their end. But, like, in the world of medical school admissions, we're really hoping to be the first. Us in Texas, we're trying to partner up with some things. And so, to me, like, this is the millennial generation. God bless you, millennials. I hope all of you are listening to this. Like, they just communicate a different way. And, you know, we were a little trepidatious at the start, but like, we didn't have much pushback or any problems at all. It's just like most of the applicants, like, oh yeah, you know, this is how we communicate. We Skype, we FaceTime, we do all this stuff. And so, it, again, you know, science is evolving. We're evolving. So I feel really excited about this. And just to give a shout out to all my supervisors, the dean of the medical school, everyone, they've been very supportive of us in our efforts just to experiment with these new assessment methods.
Yeah. Can you give us a sample question for the video?
For the video interview?
Yeah.
The way to think about it is, so there are future kind of oriented questions and past questions, behaviorally focused questions. So a good one would be, and so the cool thing about the platform is like when you go in there, they have a practice suite. Mm-hmm. And so you can practice as much as you want. And then you get to kind of watch. So it gives you like a practice question and records you, and you get to watch the recording yourself. We don't keep those. We don't store those. You have to do at least one practice session before you can go live and do the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can do 100 of those. You can do one of those. So like one of the practice questions is like, talk about a time as a leader you had to settle a dispute or conflict.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, the great one, because again, physicians mediate a lot of conflict, you know, conflict on the healthcare team, policy teams, things like that. And that would be a standard video interview question. Like, talk about a time as a leader you had to settle a conflict or dispute. So,
yeah, it is interesting. Again, in the business school world, this is used with increasing frequency. And what they're using it for actually is as a pre-interview screening tool.
Yeah.
They want to see if the applicant has poise, has presence, as well as how they actually answer a question, you know, the actual content. But it's and sometimes it's English fluency also.
Yep. So there's two ways to think about it. Right now we use it as an assessment tool, meaning all the, like we talked about earlier, all those people we invited for an interview get to do the standard video interview before they come here for the interview day.
Mm-hmm.
What you talked about is a screening tool, which we're toying with the idea with yet. That means, so like we only let 550 some odd people do the standard video interview last year because they're the ones coming here already. Mm-hmm. Now, screening tool mean to me would be like all 4,300 of the people who applied to our school get to do the video interview.
Right.
And we haven't gone down that path yet because there are technical issues and manpower issues with who's going to watch all those.
Well, they limit it to 1 minute, by the way. It's like a 1 minute. I think one school has 1 minute, some school has 5 minutes, but I think one school, there is some screening before they do the video. So there's a lot of experimentation actually.
There's a lot of variation. Every program has a different mission and different kind of community and different context. So it makes total sense to me.
Now you mentioned this earlier, I'm going to zoom out. What are some of the more common ways that applicants blow their primary and secondary applications? What are the more common mistakes?
You know, like, I got to start off the basics. So one of the most common ones to me, and just mystifies me, but are spelling mistakes, grammar mistakes. We are a detail-oriented profession. If you're applying to medical school, there's a huge difference between microgram and milligram, right? MCG versus MG. So it's astonishing to me when people don't spell check or they have poor grammar or they don't know how to use punctuation marks correctly. And and all things being equal, again, it's so competitive to get into med school. Your application is going to be roughly similar to someone else's. But if yours has tons of typos, spelling issues, grammar issues, you're not getting it. That's the way to look at it. So I've seen people misspell the word pediatrics, surgery. I mean, it just looks really bad to the admissions committee if someone doesn't proofread and doesn't pay attention to details. Another issue is, so there's 15 experiences on MCAS. You should really strive to have all 15 filled out. It's so competitive that they're, you know, again, you want to show like you're being very diligent, you're using your time wisely, and it looks strange to the committee. You're given, and it's like 15 different spots to talk to the admissions committee. I mean, this is really, really valuable real estate.
Absolutely.
So for people to only use 10 of them, it just looks bad. You know, it's like, okay, like, were you not busy enough? Because like that's what you're kind of saying. And then when people, we call it like salami slicing or stacking. Okay, like I shadowed a doctor for 5 hours and they use one section. And they shadowed a different doctor for 10 hours and they use a different section. That doesn't look very good. I mean, most like really competitive applicants collapse all their physician shadowing into one category and use other categories for community service or research or those type of activities. So stacking is another issue, or salami slicing, kind of like, you know, splitting hairs and try to like expand your application. Including stuff in high school is also a common problem. So the theory is everything you do in high school prepares you for undergrad, and areas you do in undergrad, activities you do in undergrad, prepare you for graduate school. So it looks super odd to the committee when people talk about all this stuff they did 5, 6, 7, 8 years in the past.
Or kindergarten.
Or kindergarten. Yeah, I mean, so like when people start talking about like, oh, like I won the high school debate tournament in 2011. And like the committee is looking at each other and going, it's like 7 years later. Like, what have you done recently?
Mm-hmm.
So, but you know, if the glory days are back then, I mean, I guess that's what you got to do. But
and then, yeah, but that tells you, it telegraphs to you that the glory days were back then, what's the growth?
Yeah, to me, when you apply to medical school, it's a professional application. You're applying to a prestigious graduate program, so there's no reason to include things that happen in high school. There's no reason to use poor grammar or slang. The committee wants people to spend time on their application, to craft it, to construct it in a way that puts their best selves forward. And one of the worst parts of my job, Linda, is that I have to not accept or reject thousands of really qualified kids. We have simply too few spots and too many applicants. And what I'd like to tell people is, your application is a reflection of who you are. Your application was rejected, not you personally. And you could be the best person on the planet, but if you submit an application that's full of grammar mistakes, or you don't write very seriously, or you picked weird activities to highlight, or you just interview poorly, that's a reflection of who you are. And the committee is rejecting that application. They're not rejecting you. They're just rejecting that how you portrayed yourself. And there's always next year. And I try to be very judicious. I try to be very diligent, because a lot of people contact us for feedback. We try to really provide feedback to individuals to improve their application. And there's rarely a perfect application. It's like death by 1,000 paper cuts. Like little tiny things can be improved, little areas you can like talk about things better, or you can write about them better. So again, I'm sorry, Linda, I'm back on my soapbox. I need to get back off my soapbox.
Can I ask you one more question and then close?
Yeah.
What advice, I've been a little bit negative, but what positive advice would you give to medical school applicants planning to apply to the University of Utah College of Medicine, either in 2018, i.e. this summer, or beyond?
So first of all, I would say check out our website. We have tons of information on our website.
That's true, by the way. You have one of the most informative websites out there.
And this, another thing that we try to do is we have a Facebook page. We have an Instagram account. Go in and like it, because you'll be part of the news feed. I do not take pictures of what I eat for breakfast every day and put it on there. I don't abuse you of your time. But we do put on tips how to improve your application, talk about med student life. Listen to our podcast, same thing. And then the last thing is we created some YouTube clips. And so if you go to YouTube and type in University of Utah School of Medicine, Office of Admissions, you'll be part of our YouTube feed. And I record every year. We do a new batch. I'll probably launch a new batch next couple months. There's about 30 some odd YouTube clips. They're about 3 to 5 minutes each. And I talk some more about your application, what you can do to improve, what our school looks for. You know, again, my heart goes out to all the people who are applying to medical school. It is really hard. It is really competitive. My hope is that if you look at our social media sites, if you look at our YouTube stuff, if you look at our website, if that helps your application improve and you get into our med school, or maybe not here, but you get in somewhere else, to me, I count that as a win, because I want people to pursue their dreams. And, you know, if your dream doesn't happen to happen here, but you get into another great program because you got some really good advice from us, I think that's amazing. And I wish thee well. So that's what I would say to people, like, really, I mean, really look at the, and I don't think our school is unique for having a bunch of social media stuff. I think a lot of med schools out there are doing that. So,
no, but really, your website is unusually clear. It's very clear.
I strive to be as transparent as possibly can be. So, yeah, that's what I would say. Just, you know, research it, and then you don't be afraid to use because, like, again, like, admission deans have approached me and they like how our, you know, so Utah, I would argue, and I don't have data to support this, I just have anecdotal evidence that students, the applicants from Utah, because they prepare their application to meet our criteria, our kind of recommendations, they're that much more competitive when they start applying to other medical schools across the country. So anecdotally, I feel Utah students do better than perhaps residents of another state when they start applying broadly, because we really push this message so strongly. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
And I know you got to go. So unless you want to add something, I'm just going to say this has been absolutely delightful. I want to thank you so much for joining me today. Where can listeners learn more about the University of Utah College of Medicine and the wonderful admissions advice that you do offer on your site?
So our URL address, is medicine.utah.edu/students/program/MD.
I'll link
again, just Google that and post a link to it and look for us. Our podcasts are, and our podcasts are on iTunes, and then our YouTube clips are on YouTube. Yeah.
Okay, great. We'll include links in the show notes at accept.com/256 to the University of Utah's College of Medicine. It's a very informative and clear admission site, and that might be easier than trying to write down the URL he just provided, as well as to other resources that may be helpful to listeners, including a couple of the shows that we discussed. And a final reminder from our sponsor, the 5-Step Guide to Successful Medical School Personal Statements webinar. Sign up today to learn a straightforward and effective approach to writing your personal statement. Register at accept.com/5steps. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.